Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's program of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org, on Facebook and Twitter, and on your YouTube channel, on our YouTube channel. I'm Joseph Fink, the President Emeritus of Dominican University in Marin County, California, the former Chairman of the Board of Governors of the Commonwealth Club of California, and your moderator for this evening's program. It's now my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker for this evening. Two-term mayor of San Francisco, legendary speaker of the California State Assembly, and widely regarded as the most influential African-American politician of the 20th century, Willie L. Brown, Jr. has been at the center of California politics, government, and civic life for an astonishing 50 years. His career spans the presidencies of Lyndon Johnson all the way through to Barack Obama. He's worked for every California governor from Pat Brown to Jerry Brown and to Jerry Brown again. He's left his mark on every aspect of politics and public policy in the Golden State. As the mayor of California's most cosmopolitan city, San Francisco, he became known for a variety of successful involvements in the city and is probably known as the best mayor the city has seen in the last 50 years. He was a member of the California State Assembly from 1964 to 1995. He was the Speaker of the California State Assembly from 1980 to 1995, which is the longest serving speakership in the history of California. He served two terms as the 41st mayor of San Francisco from 1996 to 2004. He's received, by the way, more than 20 honorary degrees from colleges and universities around the country. He was on the Board of Trustees of the California State University System, which has 23 campuses and 350,000 students. He was a regent for the University of California with 10 campuses and 200,000 students. He was on the Board of Trustees at Dominican University in Marin County. We have 2,500 students. At any rate, he's a man who has made his mark on this city, on this state, and on this nation. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Willie Brown.
Joseph, thank you very much for that very kind introduction. Now, I know some of you are already wondering why the stool and et cetera. Are those props? Yeah, absolutely. They're props because it was, I think, about 3 months ago that in one of those events that I was doing in the Battery in San Francisco, I bounced up the stairs, mimicking the 25-year-old. And in the process, I apparently misstepped in some fashion and created a problem with some parts of my system. So much so that I was escorted to the emergency room and they checked out, you know, and they realized that I was not pregnant, but they gave me an epidural anyway. Then they followed that up when the epidural didn't work with a series of other things. And finally, in mid-March, they proceeded to do what I have always sworn that I would never do, and that was they chopped on me. They went in and they said, we're going in to because you have some things you shouldn't have, and you probably have had them a long time, and we're going to remove them. And they went into my back, and they chopped around for a while, and they were clearly Republicans. And and I must say that it was painful, to say the least, but I am en route to recovering and being Willie Brown, etc., after listening directly to every recommendation they made. I realize which of those recommendations did not need to be followed. And I created a problem for myself because in not following those recommendations, there has been a setback. And they're now relooking at their work. And it was interesting today, each of the experts who have been involved in this repair work proceeded to say, well, you know, you have damaged my art. That's what one of the surgeons said, by lifting a couch when you should not have. I don't know how in the hell he knew I lifted a couch, but he was accurate. And so I am now severely restricted. And although all of you have witnessed the absence of the walker that I have been consigned to, the absence of the cane, if not the walker that I've been consigned to, and the fact that I stepped up here without any assistance whatsoever, you are not to say a damn word about it. But I'm obviously recovering appropriately. I must tell you also that, Joe, this is, I don't know how many years we've been doing this once a year. 10 years, at least a decade. And I am amazed. I've been told that the Commonwealth Club was upgrading. But this is, they normally have a little shitty table with a couple of glasses of water and nothing that you can really see. But this is incredible. This is, I don't know who they're expecting to make a presentation, but they've never done this for me. This is very, very impressive. And I must tell you that I'm just delighted. The backdrop and what have you makes me want to discuss global warming. Very presidential. San Francisco, obviously, is a place that I dearly love. And I'm able to, on some days, express that love in my column. I do a column for the San Francisco Chronicle, as most of you know. It's called Willie's World. So kind of what you're going to get tonight is a visit to Willie's World on kind of an extended basis with the right to raise questions with me about the content of Willie's World. I, frankly, in writing that column, never understood how reactive people can really be if you give them the opportunity. And nor did I understand how challenging it must be for the editorial writers at the Chronicle, because people react to me really directly and almost violently. In some cases, I identified Leland Yee, one of our esteemed elected officials and former school board members, etc., when he got busted and indicted for almost every offense that Al Capone dreamed of committing. I suggested in my column that Leland Yee was so insignificant that he had absolutely no impact on any public policy measure. And he really has not. You go back and look at his whole career, he's never at any point in his whole life been effective on anything. And I said, he's like the guy who, you know, rips the fruit off from the stand on the streets that nobody really cares about, because the fruit probably had a bug in it anyway. But I said that, and people went crazy. They went absolutely crazy. They thought I was, in one manner or another, sanctioning his conduct. Oh, no, not at all. By the way, he absolutely detested me. He, when he ran for mayor of San Francisco against my friend Ed Lee, you would assume that he was running against me, not Ed Lee, because he spent his whole time describing Willie Brown, etc. And about half of what he said was true. But it was really incredibly, disrespectful of me in every fashion. So I was not an Ed Lee fan, but I'm telling you, that generated more response from the public. And the public really condemned Ed Lee in every fashion. I came to the conclusion that we have arrived in San Francisco, and for the readers of the Chronicle and the readers of my column, where jaywalking for an elected official is a capital offense, period, without trial. You put them to it. That's kind of, however, where the world has evolved to since my first open impression of participating in the political process. I started, as Joe indicated, in 1962, actually, Joe. It's something that's not in the history. We don't write it. I didn't put it in my book. Nothing, because I lost the damn election. So there's no reason to remind people that the first time I ran, I got beat. I mean, you can't imagine that. I couldn't imagine that I could be defeated. But I was defeated. But from 64 on, which is the beginning of my history, I won every election. And from 64 on, I must tell you that there was nothing that was more spectacular for me in terms of personal satisfaction and ego inflating than the incredible amount of respect and response that the public afforded me all the way through my term as mayor of San Francisco, ending January 8th at 12:01, 2004. It was an incredible long tenure of experience, etc., of people reacting positively. Since that time, things have dramatically changed. And I maintain that the politicians have contributed substantially to that change. The business of decision-making is no longer as it once was. And I feel sorry, frankly, for my friend Ed Lee, because he's dealing with a situation in which people do not seem to be interested in trying to make quality decisions on behalf of all of the people. They seem to be at all times doing what is occurring in other parts of the country politically, and that is making decisions that in some manner or another cause the wind to be whatever that individual fashions, not what the public genuinely needs. Fortunately for us in San Francisco, we still have a collection of people who are dedicated to that end, but not as it was in the previous time period, in the time period when I served. You can observe that on almost a daily basis on almost every issue that comes before the public, whether it's in San Francisco, whether it's in Sacramento, or whether it's in Washington, D.C. There is just an absence of people willing to step across the aisles, so to speak, philosophically for the purpose of trying to fashion a result that makes some sense for public purposes. We, however, are probably more blessed than almost any other locale in this nation. We still have some semblance of dedication to the idea that you really ought to do good things. But there is an element of San Franciscans who really are into simply trying to make sure they rule the day. And they're doing so ultimately to the detriment of the city. Were I Monique Moyer running the San Francisco port, I would be very, very concerned about whether or not I'm going to be able to do what needs to be done on behalf of the citizens of this city if suddenly every decision vis-a-vis the port is going to be subject to the political football of a collection of people who have almost no interest, none, in the ultimate result of what happens to this city. I always said, while serving with members, and they'd come to me to raise questions about what they disagreed with me on and what, where they thought we ought to be going, I always reminded them that your disagreement must be rooted in a recommended alternative, better solution. Don't come to me with just your objections to what somebody else has recommended. Come to me with your objections, but tell me how I get to a better place based on your recommendation. And you've got to assume the responsibility to execute that recommendation. That always tended to impose upon them an obligation to be more responsible than simply being an objection person. In San Francisco, we now have a collection of really talented people, people who have held office, people who have held significant positions, but they have suddenly become almost like teabaggers. They've suddenly become individuals who simply don't want the recommendation that somebody else makes, but knowing there needs to be something done, and they don't offer an alternative. The port is the outstanding example of where that those politics are currently being practiced. Years ago, San Francisco in its port had ships that moved goods and services. Harry Bridges and the people who did the waterfront type activities, that is so much a history of a part of San Francisco. It was when the port was orchestrated as the entrance way to California for many products and goods and people. San Francisco has obviously changed in that regard because we don't have the kind of access routes beyond the receipt of goods and services that are needed to make the system work. Oakland and Seattle and Los Angeles have become those new gateways. They were not before, but they are now. So our system and our port has become something differently. When I became mayor of San Francisco, that's exactly what we discovered. We discovered a golden opportunity, however, because you, the voters, had said the freeway must go. And the freeway went, and in that process, it gave a great opportunity to do something about an area that had been devoted to something that most San Franciscans were not involved in. And so suddenly there came an opportunity for us to see the port for in a different way. And we did see the port in a different way. We put the palm trees on the port. We did a whole new configuration of the turf on which you could traverse the space that is called the port. We did, I think, a decent job of bringing old streetcars and running them down in front of the port. We really did a marvelous job of doing those things. Preceding all of that had been some people who had begun to do some alternative commerce tools for the port, and they were successfully doing that. We added to that. We expanded upon it, and we recognized almost instantly that all the things that had been built along the port and along the access to the port needed to be managed in an appropriate fashion and needed to be managed by the decision makers in the process of who deals with the port and the people who wanted to invest in the port. And we were really clear on those issues. Suddenly, however, the port has become what San Francisco once was in terms of a challenge of who could or who could not control the development of San Francisco. And so now we have a port that is clearly challenged. The infrastructure of the port is beyond anybody's comprehension in terms of the cost of trying to upgrade it, restore it, and make it seismically sound. You can only do that with a huge infusion of resources, and the public isn't willing to pay for that huge infusion of resources. Then you must make it so that somebody in the private sector can have the vision to figure out how, if they do the restoration work that we cannot do for whatever reasons we don't wish to do, then they can, and they can be compensated by some means over the next 30, 40, or 50 years as the Port of San Francisco becomes a part of the delivery system that we have. People who object to that and walk away without assuming any responsibility to offer a substitute and an alternative or doing things that are inconsistent with the needs of San Francisco and ultimately the future of San Francisco. And then there are a collection of people who absolutely abhor any newcomers. San Francisco has always been about extending the opportunity for people who want to relocate. I am an immigrant. I came from Texas, and I came here looking for a better opportunity, and I got a better opportunity. And a whole host of other people similarly situated did the same identical thing. Nobody erected a process by which I could not achieve if I wished to, if I worked hard enough, if I understood the rules and the regulations. Suddenly, this city, however, for people who are already here, are suggesting that somehow there should be no room for newcomers, that we ought to, in some manner or another, prohibit the opportunity for newcomers. We ought to become restrictive in every fashion. We have not been, obviously, as aggressive as we needed to be. It should have been a long time ago, long before I became mayor of San Francisco, we should have been about trying to figure out how to erect one more structure so that the next Willie Brown would have some place to live. We were not about that. In my administration, we actually did that. We tried our best to build as much as we could build, and you, the voters, accepted our leadership on that score. You gave us the bonded authorization in 96 to do something about that, and we did a fairly decent job of addressing that issue. In the process, we empowered a collection of people who are already here and who are our allies in that effort of convincing you it could be done. What we didn't fully appreciate is their desire to erect barriers, to not let anybody else come beyond those that we provided for through that effort. In the process, obviously, the newcomers now are no longer from China. The newcomers now are no longer from Texas. The newcomers now are no longer from Ohio or Michigan. The newcomers are from all over the place, from schools that have prepared people to be engineers, the schools that have prepared people to be executors of visionary plans using every aspect of what the engineers can produce, and these people are called techos. And suddenly, they have become the people we don't want in this town, only based upon a collection of San Franciscans. And Mayor Lee, of course, on the other hand, is doing everything he can to make sure the techos are here, because suddenly the techos represent the examples of the new economy. They represent the new opportunity to do what San Francisco has always done, and that's be on the cutting edge of everything that might happen tomorrow, and the tomorrows. But there's a collection of San Franciscans, genuine San Franciscans, talented San Franciscans, who absolutely wish in every fashion to have none of the techos. They don't want the techos here. They believe that the techos creates a problem or in some fashion for their comfort level of what they have enjoyed. And they say that as they give evidence and they offer evidence because the cost of things are going up with the influx of the techos. Well, the cost of things are going up because there has been imposed upon the city an incredible burden of how you get from conception of a living space to the production of a living space. And in that time period, the incredible delay, the incredible cost associated with it, and the incredible burdens imposed becomes ultimately the pure, unadulterated vehicle by which the cost is driven up for whoever ultimately occupies that which has been produced. And the people who are causing that in the main do not understand and do not accept the fact that they are the parties who are doing it. I have said to Mayor Ed Lee, Mr. Lee, it seems to me, at some point, you really should say to everybody who makes an application to do anything in San Francisco, from the day your application is deemed complete, there will be only X number of days of which your application will further be processed. And if at some point we engage in these dilatory tactics of delay after delay after delay, the previous date given to you on the filing of your application and the predicted date of approval, you will be deemed approved. Somehow, we've got to build a system that will rob those who are trying to make sure nobody else lives in this town, nobody else is allowed to move in this town, nothing new gets built in this town. The alteration of the existing turf and space that's already here, somehow we have got to get a handle on how we make it possible to reduce the cost and the delay. I attended a session with the mayor's housing people on Monday of this week. My friend Naomi Kelly, who is the chief administrative officer, brought in her person who does that kind of work. And during the course of the presentation about the potential for the replacement of Sunnydale, some of you may know about the existence of Sunnydale and Petrowa Hill. When she gave me the whole width and breadth of what the city could do to replace those god-awful spaces and those spaces that clearly, with the amount of land they occupy, you could almost double the number of units today if you simply went out there and tore them down and built new ones. She proceeded to tell me, we're looking at 2020 on the most optimistic fashion to deal with the issues surrounding Sunnydale and the issues surrounding Petrowa Hill, all because of these artificial barriers that have been erected by people who do not wish tomorrow to come for any newcomer who comes to San Francisco. And so the challenge in our city is pretty much laid out. We really do need, as a group of elected people, as a group of people who participate in the election process, we need to begin to hold those persons who have participated in and erected the barriers that will not permit visionaries like Ed Lee and his administration to do the job that needs to be done to keep San Francisco as interesting and as exciting and as revolutionary as it has always been. I'm frankly using the Willie's World to try our best to push it. For an example, when the Presidio Trust proceeded to say to George Lucas, we really don't want you to build a museum in our park, I went out for the night that they made the presentation. I couldn't for the life of me understand how anybody on that trust, as talented as all those people are, would take that position. And then I remembered that the busiest museum in this country is called the Spy Museum. It's in Washington, D.C. the Spy Museum wanted to locate at Pier 45 in San Francisco. That collection of people who were given the port hell, that collection of the people who were given the warrior's hell, that collection of people who were making it tough for techies to live here, stepped up to the plate, abutted and abated by a collection of some of my friends, and the argument was, yeah, we'll provide an alternative. We will put in a water-based museum instead of the Spy Museum, and that would be a better thing and a better image for our city. Today, those persons have never been heard from again. The Spy Museum opened in Washington, D.C. It's now the busiest museum in the country, and because of 24, the blacklist, Snowden, and a whole collection of people, including Dianne Feinstein, the issue of spy has become more relevant than almost anything else. And just think, if we had the Spy Museum in San Francisco, we would obviously be in the forefront, more so than we are, of every aspect of what people are discussing on the spy side. That same collection of people kept us from getting the Spy Museum. The people who are doing what they're attempting to do to George Lucas are operating in the same identical fashion. Sure, the Lucas Museum ought to be in San Francisco, and there ought to be a place for the Lucas Museum in San Francisco. And George Lucas is doing what I think Don Fisher did before he died. Don Fisher ran into the same wall in the Presidio when he said, I have $1 billion in an incredible modern art collection that I want to give to the city of San Francisco, and I want to build a house in which to put it in. I want to do the technological changes that are necessary that will maintain it in perpetuity. And that same board that he was chairman of rejected his offer. He walked away, resigned, and came over to the Museum of Modern Art in the South of Market area and said, I know you have a building that's only been in place for 10 or 12 years. If you modify this building, go up 10 stories, reorient it the entranceway, I'll give you enough money to do all of that, and you can house my collection. Fortunately, the trustees at that museum were more visionary than the trustees at the Presidio. They were more accommodating than our board of supervisors at the time of the Spy Museum, and they stepped in and said, let's do it. In another year and a half, it will be opened, and it'll be better than the Guggenheim Museum. It'll be one of the most incredible museums in the whole world, all devoted to modern art. The George Lucas Museum could very well be in the same way. He is sitting here with $700 million of his own money. Not a nickel of public money would be involved in that effort. Yet, with the Presidio, and I assume that the people who are the trustees at the Presidio are more interested in what the anti-Hetch Hetchy people were. They want to somehow go back to a time that nobody really knows whether or not it ever existed. When they start talking about making it original, that nobody knows what the hell they're talking about when they say original. Well, we went through that. We defeated that effort, but we've been unable to touch that group of trustees out there, and I'm just hopeful that we can accommodate the George Lucas facility just as we've accommodated a number of other things. And you should know that in the process, I'm also hoping we can figure out how to move the Raiders to San Francisco. And now I know that there are some people that have raised questions about my sanity on that issue, but it's not unusual for me to evidence insanity as we go about trying to move things. And then somebody a few days ago said to me, well, I might say okay on the Raiders, but we don't want the Raiders fans. I said, I agree. I want the Raiders. I don't want the damn fans. We have the fans in San Francisco who have been ultimately rejected by the 49ers because they have moved down to Santa Clara. And I'm not going to Santa Clara for any reason. If I wanted to. And so as part of what San Francisco is all about, obviously that's one of the things that this city would really be about. I'm glad the Warriors are here, and I hope somehow we are able to rise above it all and we're able to achieve the goal of doing what needs to be done to allow Monique Moya and the waterfront to continue the magnificent progress that has been evidenced by the restoration of the Ferry Building, by the number of things that are on the waterfront now, including one that I didn't know about. A few days ago, I got a request from the Bloomberg broadcast people. They wanted me to come and do something on, you know, the world of finance. And I've been to the Bloomberg studio in New York many times. There is a comparable studio in San Francisco for Bloomberg broadcasting. Where is it? Pier 1 in San Francisco. Many months ago, somebody called to my attention the fact that there was a world-class photo museum in San Francisco. I didn't know about that either. And I said, where in the hell is that? They said, it's Pier 24. I went looking for Pier 24. I couldn't find Pier 24. Finally, some homeless person led me to 24. I gained admission to 24. It was almost like trying to get into the Pentagon. But when I got in there, I clearly understood. There is a world-class, and I mean a real world-class, photo museum equal to any that exists anywhere in the world on our port at Pier 24. That process can be replicated repeatedly if we could only do something about that collection of people who really belong in some place that isn't San Francisco. Thank you.
Our thanks to Willie Brown, the former mayor of San Francisco, a noted political commentator, for his remarks this evening. Now we have a number of questions from the audience, Mr. Mayor, and they pertain to San Francisco, but also the state of California and to the United States at large. And let me start with the questions regarding the United States and what is happening now. You were one of the original supporters of Barack Obama. I remember that you had a fundraiser for him when he was running for the Senate in Illinois, as a matter of fact. He went through a very inspirational election in 2008, but now his approval ratings have fallen, and many of his supporters are disappointed with what's happening. Are you disappointed?
I am disappointed in the absence of the boldness that I had hoped for Barack Obama. I understand, however, how you cannot project upon someone elected to public office the kind of things you would do if you held the position. I am ecstatic over the fact that he did what I think Roosevelt started, and that is the expansion of health coverage to every human being in America. And he has achieved he has achieved that goal. I am impressed with some of the people that he has appointed to cabinet-level positions and other positions. I'm disappointed in the fact that he kept too many of the Bushites in significant positions of influence. I'm pleased that he has understood and is executing an exit policy out of the Middle East so that the war will not continue with America's assistance, etc. And so my displeasure is because I am holding Barack Obama to a standard incapable of being met by anybody.
Thank you. You were once quoted as saying the following: in politics, a lie unanswered becomes truth within 24 hours. Now, that basically was a statement saying that if you allow untruths to continue, people will believe they're true. What happened with the Obama administration and Obamacare that they allowed it to become such a negative instrument for the Republican Party?
Well, President Obama got really bad, bad advice from his people to whom he gave the assignment for the implementation. He was very fortunate in that Nancy Pelosi was the speaker at the time that Obamacare was on the agenda, and that she orchestrated the process by which Obamacare became the law. From that moment on, however, the implementation and the quality of the people given the assignment to implement it did not match the people who orchestrated the policy. For an example, there was, I think, a representation made by somebody who said, if you're trying to reach the kind of people and the number of people you're trying to reach, maybe you should take a avenue and a vehicle that's currently reaching all those people. What avenue is reaching all those people? Obviously, Medicare was reaching many of those people. And if you'd use the same avenue that Medicare was using, and you said you were doing that, you would have eliminated almost instantly the guesswork that came with a new app, the guesswork that came with a new software, because clearly all of the bugs had been worked out, or most of the bugs had been worked out on how you reach people if you're trying to make sure they get some form of medical care because of age, because of disability, and all the other things surrounding it. And it had come over a series of years when there was virtually no objections to trying to do that. When you know that there is a cadre of people who are objecting to everything you're doing, and you're playing around with experiments as if you're making a Star Wars movie, you're bound to have a disaster. That's one. Number two, could have very easily said, okay, we're going to farm out the business of reach outreach. We're going to get Kaiser. We're going to get a collection of other organizations like Kaiser, and we're going to contract with them to start the process. We eventually may establish a public set of bureaucrats to manage this, but we're going to start with a method that is already proven to work because it's producing positive profits for people in the healthcare delivery system. He didn't do any of those things, and that obviously created a problem, resulting in a very talented woman being fired over something she didn't have control of. Catherine Sebelius is a really talented person. She has now walked the plank, and she has walked the plank because an inept operation centered in the White House.
Thank you. We're a long way from 2016, and it's conventional wisdom that if Hillary Clinton decides to run, she'll be the party's nominee. Is the Benghazi incident still going to have legs, do you think, in 2016, and will it haunt her?
No, I don't think that anything that the Republicans can do will haunt Hillary. She really is in an ideal position with the American people. And if she does what I think she will do, and that's make her candidacy a referendum on female leadership, she will be in a position to overcome almost any challenge to her previous participation, because the issue will always start with the gender gap. And I think she'll be okay.
Okay, thank you. One more question about national politics. Has the Tea Party reached its peak and is now on a downward spiral?
I think the Tea Party has reached its peak. I think you're going to see almost every report forthcoming of a loss by the Tea Party in Republican primaries all over the country. They were successful 4 years ago in knocking out a couple of U.S. senators, one in Utah, one in a couple of other places. They got nominees in Connecticut and in Missouri and a couple of other places, but they proved not to be acceptable to the general public. And the Republicans are becoming practical enough to go back to the quality candidacies of people registered as Republicans, and they are embracing quality candidacies and not the insanity and the madness of the Tea Party.
Does that not pose a real problem for the Democratic Party in the elections of 2014, then, as far as the Senate is concerned? If there are more moderate Republicans running, does that mean the Republican Party will take control of the Senate? And if they do, does that mean Barack Obama will be a lame duck president?
Well, I think that the Democratic Party should really encourage the Tea Party people. I think it would be very helpful to keep that contrast in place. Although in California, you know, you have the weird situation statewide, you no longer have party choices. You now can vote for whomever. And the Republicans are being very smart. While they are taking a real hit PR-wise that there are no real Republicans, Jim Brulte is more concerned about and more interested in what the end result of the policy issues are. And he doesn't care whether it's a moderate Democrat like a Dianne Feinstein carrying the water or a moderate Republican carrying the water. And so where there are nonpartisan opportunities, many Republicans are embracing the most conservative Democrat in the contest, and thereby they will have a profound influence on the final result. On whether or not a Barack Obama will suffer the status of being a lame duck president, I don't think he will frankly care. I think that he is so unengaged with what happens on a daily basis in the halls of the legislature that many of the people who think that they can annoy him by whatever they wish to enact, I think it's clear in his mind that they don't have enough votes to override his veto. And whatever they send him, he will veto it and spend more time taking credit for the veto than for passing anything.
Okay, thank you. There's somewhat of a segue in there into state politics. What are your views about Jerry Brown as governor?
Jerry Brown has, he enjoys the legacy of some 50-plus years of people thinking positively about the name Brown. And he does almost nothing to take away in any fashion from that legacy. And with the absence of quality competition for the main stage, Jerry Brown is enjoying an unprecedented ride as the governor of this state. He does not have to undertake and try to meet the challenge, let's say, of dealing with the issue of pension reform. He doesn't have to deal with the drought. I mean, this guy is unbelievable. He is above it all. He flies with out wings, and seems not to crash. And that's a really good thing. And in part, it's because he is so personally talented, intellectually speaking. and the press is so intimidated. The journalists really are intimidated by Jerry Brown. They'll ask him a question, and he will answer the question, they think. But they're not sure. But they're afraid to challenge the answer because they don't want you to know they didn't understand it. And so he enjoys a wonderful acceptance. He doesn't have to go to editorial boards. He doesn't have to hold press conferences if he chooses not to. He can get away with staging everything that he does. And on occasions, he actually does some good things. Often enough so that he's not a suspect.
All right, thank you. Would you like to describe the relationship between the governor and the lieutenant governor?
The lieutenant governor was an opponent in the Democratic primary of the person who ultimately won. He withdrew from that, from being the opponent. And he subsequently lowered his perspective and became a candidate for a job that he maintains doesn't provide anybody with anything except a title. And he is enjoying, frankly, holding a job that gives him a title and gives him a platform. He has shown zero interest and trying to develop a working relationship with Jerry Brown. Jerry Brown has shown even less interest in trying to work a relationship with Gavin Newsom. And as a matter of fact, I think they programmed themselves not to be in the same county on any occasion, and they certainly programmed themselves not to address the same subject matter. If you're talking about medical marijuana, Jerry Brown acts as if he doesn't even understand the language. And Newsom, of course, is front and center on that issue. If you're talking about building a water system to go to Southern California, Newsom is busy at that moment discussing tech issues rather than commenting on whether or not water should go to Southern California. So we have an odd situation in this state of a lieutenant governor and a governor who are not on any time working together on anything, period. We really should change the nature of the jobs. We really should say it's got to be like the president and the vice president. The governor should have a profound influence on who gets the job of the lieutenant governor, because after all, the lieutenant governor theoretically is supposed to step into the shoes of the governor. I can assure you that if Jerry Brown left the governorship and Newsom stepped in, there would be a lot of real estate and houses available in Sacramento because Newsom would fire everybody that works for Jerry Brown, everybody, no matter what title they had or what have you. He would cleanse the state of everything having to do with Jerry Brown. On the other hand, Jerry Brown would look forward to doing Newsom's eulogy.
For those of you in our listening audience, this is the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. And our guest this evening is Willie Brown, the former mayor of San Francisco and the noted political commentator, who's talking with us about national, state, and local politics. Governor Brown, in his first term, was known as Governor Moonbeam. And now he's concerned that legalizing marijuana would be a negative because of the fact that we would lose our competitive edge if too many of our citizens were stoned. What's your position on the legalization of marijuana?
I was really ahead of my time. Just before Jerry Brown became Governor Moonbeam, I was an advocate with Normal for the reform of all the marijuana laws in this country. I carried the bill that reduced the penalties on the possession of a small amount of marijuana from a crime to a citation offense. Late George Moscone carried it in the Senate, and we got that down into law. So I've been way ahead of Jerry Brown on this issue, and I suspect that I will stay ahead of Jerry Brown on this issue. And the one thing that I'm disappointed in is that when the voters said yes on medical marijuana, and somebody came to me and said, listen, there's going to be dispensaries in San Francisco, and I think you ought to invest in a dispensary and run a dispensary. And Eleanor, who was the chief of staff, wouldn't let me do that. I'm still working. I wouldn't have to work if I had that dispensary, period. But I am and I think Jerry Brown is, frankly, wrong, totally and completely on that issue. Colorado has just said okay to recreational marijuana. I think state of Washington has said okay. There are now about 20 states that have said okay to medical marijuana, with California being probably the big dog in that sense of the word. And I do believe that the feds should remove marijuana as one of the severely restricted drugs so that the benefits of the use of that particular drug would be available to people who have bad backs.
Thank you for that professional. One more question about California, and then we'll turn to the city. What's your now that we've had some time, what's your view of the gubernatorial terms of Arnold Schwarzenegger?
Arnold Schwarzenegger was my good friend, so I'm not objective at all. I mean, not at all. I don't even. Arnold Schwarzenegger was only one of two elected officials that showed up at my house this time. He heard. He was in town, and he heard that I was home recuperating. And he dropped what he was doing to come over to visit. So anything I say about Arnold has to be colored with my profound personal friendship with him. As governor of this state, he got off to a very bad start. He decided to challenge all of the elements that were on the Democratic side of the aisle, and it proved to be a complete disaster. He lost that fight, period. He then, redid his operation, got himself reelected with a popular vote of the people of the state of California, and for the limited period of time that he stayed there while in the governorship in his second term, he was an okay governor. He is currently, what did he tell me the other day? He's in Louisiana shooting Terminator 7 or something. and he's seriously thinking about coming back and running for governor again.
All right, a number of questions about the city now. First of all, what grade would you give Ed Lee thus far as mayor of San Francisco?
It's incomplete, because his term isn't up till next year. I must tell you, though, that he is an outstanding student. The fact that he's held on to the Warriors in spite of the insanity of the people that I talked about in my formal remarks, the business of not taking my advice and keeping the meters operating on Sunday, he decided he wouldn't take my advice, and he said it's okay to park free on Sunday. That was a good decision on his part. His goal to have 30,000 units of housing before he leaves the mayorship is a good thing because it's going to force him to do some of the things that I talked about in my former remarks, and that is it's going to force him to come down hard on delay, 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 and I think he will, in fact, do exactly that. He is having a good rise and a good run with the tech world. And what has occurred in mid-market is an incredible achievement. I didn't even visit mid-market when I served as mayor. It was so bad. He did, and in the process, mid-market is now becoming an interesting, an exciting place, and it's only going to get better under his leadership. When I say incomplete, I am accurate. There's so many things that he has on plate that he's doing, including trying to figure out how to do the transit system better than the transit system has been done, and how to deal with the homeless issue better than it's been done. And I marvel at the fact that he has managed to corner the market on red and green paint. Have you noticed that every street now has red and green paint on it? I don't know why, but when somebody on the streets asked me a few days ago, as mayor, what do you think about that red and green paint? I said, well, you know, I'm an admirer of all paint. and I'm going to ask my friend, at what point will he be putting down some blue paint? Okay. Obviously, I'm blue.
Your comments about workers in the technology field in the city drew a number of questions, and one of them was fairly thoughtful, and I'd like to read it in its entirety to you and ask you to respond. With the rising cost of living in San Francisco, pricing out artists and musicians and those that work in the service industry, how do you see the city able to maintain its cosmopolitan status if those that have given San Francisco its character can no longer afford to live here?
First and foremost, I think San Francisco's character comes from the totality of the people who live here, not from the people who draw or sculpture or play music, period. I think it comes from all of us who are here. And I think the beauty of this city is there is constantly a change in the makeup of that diversity. We have tried in this city in the late 80s. Somebody came up with the idea that artists and people like that were finding it difficult to live here. And the city enacted something called live-work housing. We removed the requirement for parking. We removed the contribution to schools. We removed the kind of standards you impose upon housing for families and what have you, all with the idea that we needed to provide this avenue for that collection of people to continue to live here. Not one of them ever moved in. The live-work became the incubator for the new smart people who wanted to live in San Francisco and who ultimately became a part of the tech world. They became a part of the bioscience world. They became a part of, and so you cannot simply fashion the process in such a way that you gear it to one segment of the population. You must deal with the totality. For an example, there is an organization called the Academy of Arts University. It's got 57 buildings in downtown San Francisco. And she literally has outsmarted Golden Gate University, SF State, University of California Medical Center, USF, and all the other institutions, because she figured out that if you're going to have a successful university, you had to have some place for your students to live. You're not going to build dormitories ultimately achieve that goal because you're not going to have the resources to do it. So she has taken existing buildings and modified those buildings on an interior space basis, and she houses virtually in student housing all of the people that go to her university. A very smart move, and obviously a very financially successful one. We as a city need to do that in order to afford everybody who wishes to live here the opportunity to live here.
Thank you. Unfortunately, Willie, we only have time for one more question. You know, it's hard to believe this, but you turned 80 on March the 20th. And as you know, my birthday is also March the 20th, although a few years earlier. So I'm interested in what kind of advice you might have for me so that by the time I'm 80, I can be as intellectually stimulating, amazingly articulate, and followed by as many women as you are around the city.
There are a series of assumptions in your question that may or may not have any legitimate foundation. I would highly recommend to you, however, that Denise is enough.
Thank you. You stand up, please. Stand up. Stand up. Thank you. For those of you in the radio audience, he was referring to my lovely wife. Thank you, Willie. Our thanks to Willie Brown, the former San Francisco mayor and political commentator. We also would like to thank our audiences here on radio, television, and the Internet. I'm Joseph Fink, the moderator for this evening, the president emeritus of Dominican University, and now the moderator for the Commonwealth Club of California program, the place where you're in the know. This particular program is now closed. Ladies and gentlemen, Mayor Brown needs to leave immediately. Would you please just stay and give him a chance to...
I have another engagement that's starting at 7 o'clock, and I got to try to get there. So otherwise, I'd stick around and hang out and see what I could collect. All right.